In a year when the Commission is refocusing its regulatory agenda and floating major proposals on capital formation and reporting frequency, understanding the rulemaking process is more important than ever for issuers, investors, and advisors. From the proposing release to the final rule, today we're pulling back the curtain on how SEC rules actually get made and digging into some of the current proposals out for public comment. Welcome to KPMG's Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your new host, Melissa Rocha, a partner in KPMG's national office. Our guest today, Brian Breheny, is a partner at Skadden and the founder and co-head of the firm's SEC reporting and compliance practice. Brian is also a former SEC senior lawyer, where he served as the office chief of the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions and deputy director for legal and regulatory policy, where he oversaw the rulemaking process. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Brian also started his career as an accountant at KPMG. Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for asking me to be here, and glad you highlighted my career that started off at KPMG in New York. I spent 4 years on the audit staff in the New York office, so happy to be with you. And of course, I had the pleasure of working with you at the SEC. I'm so glad when you joined KPMG. Great. You're a great resource. So thanks for asking me to join.
Oh, great. Great. So let's dig right in. I want to sort of set the stage as I teed it up. You worked in various roles at the SEC, including overseeing the rulemaking process, and now advise clients from the outside. So I'm really curious what looks most different to you about the commission's current rulemaking environment compared to when you were there.
Well, look, I mean, when I was at the SEC and I was deputy director in the division, oversaw the rulemaking agenda. And I think if you go back and look at the, say, last 30 years of rulemaking, it kind of ebbs and flows depending upon kind of the issues. Sarbanes-Oxley, of course, led to a tremendous amount of rulemaking at the SEC. Dodd-Frank led to a tremendous amount of rulemaking, sort of mandated congressional, you know, action, right? Statutes, laws that require the commission to take action. The current environment is not being driven by congressional action. These are not sort of mandatory, but it's very much driven by, you know, Paul Atkins, who's the chair of the SEC, who, you know, was a commissioner when I was at the SEC, and I worked with him and his staff, you know, on a bunch of rulemaking matters. But Paul has come in with an ambitious, you know, agenda to kind of rethink the SEC's rules, to find a way, as he's characterizing, to make IPOs great again. So I think he's trying his best to find ways to eliminate what he views as burdensome regulatory requirements. And as a result, and you know, we're going to talk about rulemaking today, but beyond the rulemaking, the staff itself, both the accounting staff and the legal staff, have been really accommodating and flexible and finding ways to give either new guidance, which now is called CFIs, Corp Fin interpretations, as opposed to the CDIs, which was what they were called before, but nevertheless, staff interpretation, and also letters. So I'd say in the first Trump administration, when Jay Clayton was the chair, people used to say, like, you know, we're open for business. So, like, come in and ask for, you know, if you have, you know, ideas or issues with how the rules are applying, you know, come in and talk to us. I don't know what the characterization today is, but, like, really open for business. they are very, very accommodating, which I think is great. I mean, in some of these things so far, I think there's things that have been on the books for a while that people are complaining about, and they want to be flexible. So anyway, there's a lot that they have proposed. Of course, nothing has been adopted yet. Lots of thinking going on. Lots of interesting things have been proposed, and there'll be more to come. So I'd say characterizing the current rulemaking is they've really kind of rethinking a bunch of rules that have been on the books for a while to see if they could be more accommodating.
Yeah. I think it's funny that you mentioned, you know, saying they're open for business. I felt like when I was on staff, and I always would, you know, speak on panels, I'd say, you know, pick up the phone, call us. We're not that bad. You know, we're not that mean. And so, you know, they continue to say it. And I agree with you. I think from our perspective as well, you know, we're seeing the same thing where they're more accommodating, more collaborative. And so that's really nice. And also on the staff guidance piece, I had the opportunity to sit down with Heather Rosenberger, the chief accountant in Corp Fin, and I asked her about, you know, the guidance that they've, you know, put out, which seemed to be sort of a bridge while they waited for rulemaking to be released, and whether that was something that they would continue to do. And she had indicated that they would, you know, probably continue to do both, continue to provide guidance while they're working through the rulemaking process. So I think we're seeing that
That's great.
Well. Yeah.
Awesome.
So let's dig into the process itself. I get a lot of questions on how it works, how long it'll take. So I really get the sense not a lot of people really understand that process. And so it would be helpful from like a proposal or even concept release to an adopting release for you to talk about that process and maybe how long it could take.
Mitch, I think this is right. The only thing that's come out so far as a concept release under Paul Atkins' tenure has been the foreign private issuer, concept release, which is, concept release is really the SEC's like, hey, we're thinking about some ideas. Here's some of the things we thought about. Here's a bunch of questions we have. Kind of, what do you think? It's really a way to kind of solicit, public feedback, which we'll talk about. I think we might talk later about the sort of reconsideration of Regulation SK, underlying basis of all of the disclosure rules. They are similarly thinking about that. They haven't put out a concept release. They put out a request for comment. So they put out basically a statement says, hey, we're doing this. If you have any ideas for us, please submit comments. So sort of two similar ways to kind of get action. Sometimes they do roundtables. So similarly, trying to get feedback. I think as a result of the point we talked about earlier, which is they are very much open for business. They mean they want to be flexible. I think most people are taking the concept release and the request for comment very seriously. You're seeing some pretty significant responses to that. Okay. The foreign private issuer concept release is really kind of driven in some ways by geopolitical considerations. So we'll see what will come of that. So that's concept release. And honestly, you put concept releases out, and you may or may not see anything from that. Again, it's this, hey, we're thinking about this. What do you think? And if they don't get good feedback or something gets in the way of the agenda, you may not see much. Like, for instance, I spent a significant amount of my time at the end of my tenure at the SEC trying to put out this concept release on the U.S. Proxy voting system, which came out in the summer of 2010. And there was a lot of ideas in there, and it took years for some of it, but a lot of it has never been addressed. So we may not see anything. That's concept release. On the proposing releases, now you actually have, hey, we're actually showing you exactly what we think we might change the rule. There is a whole process. And if you've had any chance to look at these proposals, there's a whole administrative law requirement that goes into that. So we got to tell people what the rules are going to be. Here's the changes. And then lots of sort of background of why they're making the changes. And then there's a whole, what I call the sort of back part of the release, which is cost-benefit analysis, and there's a whole economic analysis that's done by the accountants at the SEC. There's a bunch of small business initiatives. There's a lot of things that kind of are driven really importantly, by the way, because some of these rules will get challenged, and they'll get challenged on that back of the release section I'm talking about. It's a lot of administrative procedures to it. So then the proposal comes out. Then they have a comment period, which is a public comment period, and they set a date. Hey, we want all comments by whatever date they choose. Usually, 60 to 90 days after the release goes in the Federal Register. But comments continue to sprinkle in after that, and the staff will accept kind of any comments that they receive. Some of those comments are written, and there's also times when people go in and have meetings with the staff. All of that is publicly known, because anytime anyone comes in to meet with the staff, they'll post it in the comment process. You can see all this online is the point. You'll see, hey, the ABA, the KPMG, SCADA, whoever submits a comment, it's all publicly available. You can see what happens. And then from that, the staff and the commission and the commissioner's staff have to kind of review these comment letters and kind of get the feedback. I always found the comment letter process and the dialogue and conversations that we had with people after rules were proposed to be the most helpful part of the process, especially when you get a comment letter for somebody like KPMG or the ABA or the Society of Corporate Governance, people who live with these rules every day. And notwithstanding the fact the staff may have spent a lot of time thinking about the rules and getting feedback internally from people and soliciting ideas with, when the rules get out, inevitably, you're going to pick up on stuff and they're going to say, oh, wait a second, did you think about this? Staff will say, oh, wow, that's interesting. We hadn't thought about that. Let's fix it in the adopting release. If it gets to adoption, right? So there are things that are proposed that never get to adoption, either because the response is negative or the administration changes, or there's a whole bunch of reasons why things may not get adopted. But if it gets adopted, same process. Now you've got the in staff who have to kind of take advantage of the comments. And in the adopting release, they'll similarly explain kind of here are the rule changes that we're adopting. Here's why we're adopting it. Here's the comments we received. We accepted this comment. We didn't accept that comment. All of that is a little bit up to the drafter and the commission to decide what they want to address. Not every comment, for instance, will get addressed, but a lot of them do, because you want to make sure if somebody called something out and you didn't fix it, you want to explain kind of why you didn't fix it or why you didn't think the fix was necessary. And then the commission has to vote on that. That's a whole process. Every rule proposal and adoption has to go through the commission. Currently, there's three commissioners. There's a chair, and then there's Mark Ueda and Hester Persa, the two other Republican commissioners, and no Democratic commissioners right now. Hester, by the way, is finishing up her term soon. Soon, we're going to be down to two commissioners unless somebody gets appointed confirmed. Everything that's working, and we're talking Corp Fin here, right? We also have other divisions at the SEC who are similarly trying to get things up to the commission. It all has to go to the commission and their staff. They all have to review and comment. So anytime there's a delay or a process, you know, people think like, why isn't that out? I mean, the work has to get done. Everybody in the building has to weigh in if they have a view, right? The accountants, the economists, the lawyers, the staff of the commission. So it can take some time. And then these days, you sort of hear a lot of this has to be run by the White House, right? They've set up an office within the White House that kind of has to approve, notwithstanding, you know, the SEC is an independent agency. All of that stuff is, that's a level that I didn't have to deal with when I was there, yeah. But that's part of the process too.
Yeah, I was going to ask
anyway,
you.
And then it gets adopted.
Yeah. I was like, I think that OIRA process is really new. So I was going to have you chat about that. But yeah, that's definitely new this time around.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I don't know, you know, you hear rumblings about it. That office is publicly posting when they have things. So we get like a preview. A lot of what's happening at the SEC right now is getting done by what they call seriatim, meaning the commissioners are voting on it, but they're not having an open meeting. It's my understanding that the current, like Paul Atkins, I think his view is like, we've got these three commissioners that, as a general matter, they're all, it's not going to happen if the three of them don't agree. And like, why do we have to have an open meeting that, you know, what, just put out seriatim. And that means as soon as you get the votes, like when I was at the SEC and you were moving the release around, it would go to one commissioner's office. When they signed it, it went to the next commissioner's office and so on. But none of that is public, so you don't know. And then all of a sudden, you get the fifth commissioner sign off, and you're like, oh, okay, we're ready to go. Post suddenly, the world sees a release on the SEC. We're like, whoa, I didn't know that was coming. If there's an open meeting, there's a requirement that you let people know at least 7 days in advance. So you know it's coming. And the agenda is available. So you know what the topic is going to be. So anyway, if it's done by seriatim, the commissioners are signing it, you don't know about it because there's no meeting. But now we see this process at the White House. So it's getting posted. So for instance, like semi-annual, you know, proposal, which I think we'll talk about later, and the securities offering reform and the seasoned issuers, all of that was on the White House's website. You could see it, you know, so it was like a preview. You know, I'll leave aside the sort of politics of what's happening in that office. I don't know, you know, and look, and I don't even know. We certainly got calls from folks on Capitol Hill, as you may recall. We certainly got letters, and I suspect when I was there, the chairs were probably getting more sort of political pushback than I was even aware of. But in my experience, it wasn't like we were negotiating with folks at the White House on some of these things. At least not, I wasn't. So this seems a little bit more involved to me. But again, maybe there was more that was going on behind the scenes and I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, very interesting. And you can see, I know there's the crypto proposing release that was submitted to OIRA. So that's the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. And as you indicated, you could go to that website and kind of track it by agency. So there's a crypto proposing release that's on there now. That's been sitting there since March. But then, you know, you can also click on it and see what's come out. And so that's, you know, the three that you just referenced. Not to throw a curveball, but you mentioned the commissioners and Commissioner Persa, who's leaving. Does going down to two commissioners change the process in any way? Is that going to be problematic?
I don't think so. I have not looked into this myself, but I have seen some folks write about that in the past a commission had gone down to two, and I think they changed their rules to allow for action to be taken by just the two commissioners. But that's a consideration, obviously, for the General Counsel's Office at the SEC. And I haven't heard any rumblings about any, we're down to Democratic commissioners, there's supposed to be two more. And Hester is a holdover, right? Hester, you know, her term actually ended last year. And so, you know, you're allowed to hold over, I think, for like one more year. So she's kind of at the very end of her tenure. She's made it very clear she's going. So I don't know. We'll see if we get some action to put some people in there. If not, I think they'll be able to continue to operate. It will just be, you know, Paul Atkins and Mark. And of course, they'll have to agree, but they generally do. By the way, both Mark and Hester worked for Paul Atkins when I was at the SEC. So they, you know, they know each other very well. So I wouldn't suspect that they will, you know, not be aligned. So, but I don't think it's going to halt if it's just the two of them.
Okay. Perfect. Okay, so let's dive into some of the proposals that are out there. So semiannual came out first. That's a 60-day comment period, which is due the 6th of July. What do you see as the benefit in that proposal? I mean, are there any operational challenges companies should be thinking of? What are some of your clients concerned about or considering?
Yeah, and this is going to be interesting. I read there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that said something like, you know, semiannual reporting is an answer to a problem nobody had or something like that. I mean, it's obviously that was one person's view. Clearly, some people might disagree. I mean, look, if you even look today at foreign private issuer clients who don't have to do quarterly reports, right? They have to do an annual, a 20F, and then they need to file things with the SEC on 6K to the extent that they're doing something locally or it's required by an exchange. You know, most of the large foreign private issuers, at least the ones that I work with, are doing some variation of quarterly reports, right? They don't have a Q, but they're doing earnings releases, earnings calls, earnings deck, right? Which you typically see. Again, not required, but because they want to share information with their investors, they want to share information with the market, they want analysts to track them, they want to open trading windows for people, so they don't want to be sitting on material non-public information. So there's a lot of reasons why, even though foreign private issuers are not required to do it, they're doing it anyway. And so anyway, the reason why I'm mentioning that is like, I suspect that if this, first off, let me say, this one is getting adopted. And it's going to get adopted quickly. I mean, this is one that the president, you know, tweeted about or whatever he does. And he asked the SEC to look into it during the during his first administration. Jay Clayton and that SEC, I think, had like a roundtable on it. I mentioned earlier that sometimes the staff or the commission uses roundtables to get feedback and then nothing happened. So here we are again. And so I think this is one that I suspect we will see this adopted by the end of the year. And I suspect it will be available to companies who would like to choose to do semi-annual reporting starting in 2027. That's my prediction. This one has got legs. And I think the staff is moving on it quickly because of the momentum and in particular because of the push from the president. So if it gets adopted, companies are going to have to decide, do I continue to do, you know, my three 10Qs like I've always done? And or do I switch to a 10S is what they're calling it in the proposal. So that would be a 6-month report. So you do a 10K and a 10S, continue to do a 10K and three 10Qs. Now, whether they do that and switch, I don't think the vast majority of companies are going to stop doing earnings calls, earnings releases, earnings decks, or whatever they decide to do as part of their, for the reasons I mentioned. I just feel like there's too much momentum. The market expects to see it. And at the end of the day, will they not file the 10Q because they feel like there's some benefit to that? I don't see it. I really don't. I mean, I've heard some of the staff talk about examples of companies, for instance, or like in the, you know, medical space, right? Where there's everything, your results are really driven by, you know, your testing and FDA approvals, things like that, where there's not a lot of revenue to the company. So maybe getting the financial statements and the footnotes and the information that comes along with the 10Q is just not helpful. But I think the vast majority of seasoned companies, I predict, we'll see, will continue to do 10Qs. Because when you weigh it all out, including issues like comfort letters that we all need from you guys, you know, like to get things done, how are we going to do that, right? If we're not doing it, if you're not reviewing every quarter, you're going to review the 10S, but you're not going to review. So what happens if you need, you know, information from March, the end of, you know, the first quarter or the third quarter, like, what are you going to like have the auditors come in and review that then? And to get, I don't know, it's like a process that, and that part of the, that particular comment I'm talking about will get picked up, I suspect, in the whole rulemaking process. People are weighing in on that and how that's going to work. Just feel like there's too much hair on it. Now, I don't know. I'll be surprised to see if I'm proven wrong on that. I feel like I suspect they'll adopt it. People have the flexibility. We'll see some small group of companies use it. I do not think it's going to be the vast majority of the big companies, but I suppose we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple things there that you said. So I think you and I actually heard Director Maloney talk about, you know, they thought maybe those smaller biotechs and the technology companies and maybe even some community banks would be the ones that would maybe benefit from it. And it's funny because in conversations with other companies, regardless of industry or size, they're all really thinking about it. But yeah, to your point, I think they'll, even though there's that hybrid approach where you can continue to release earnings, I think I sort of agree personally, they're really considering it, but they may end up just sticking with quarterly. We'll see. And it's funny, I'm so glad to hear you say or give a prediction on timing, because I have an internal bet with the SEC team on what, like, which proposal will get adopted and which one will go first. And this one was mine. So I thought for sure this one would probably get adopted first. But that's a pretty fast turnaround to be able to then possibly, you know, check the box on your 2026 10K and opt in to semi-annual. That's a really quick one.
It is quick. Yeah. Uh-huh. I went back and looked. I think the quickest one that I ever worked on was amendments to the cross-border tender offer rules, which is a sort of a niche area, but it was one that I was responsible for when I was M&A chief. And there was just very, you know, we were basically proposing to revise the rules to codify a bunch of relief the staff had been given in no actions letters anyway. And we got very limited feedback. We like proposed in May and adopted in October. But, you know, this is a significant one, right? And it's, I think, a little bit different in cross-border. But because of the political momentum, I think they'll move to it. And again, it's voluntary, right? So it's like, if you don't want to follow it, you don't have to. Right. And so it just gives people flexibility. So I feel like this one, I think you're going to win that bet. I hope you bet something good.
All right, I'll keep you posted. What about filer status? Let's pivot to that. I mean, any thoughts you have on that proposal?
Yeah, so this is a comprehensive package of amendments that will transform the filer status framework, which will, if adopted, will simplify the status definitions and extend the sort of scale disclosure that's available, you know, to a lot more companies. As you probably know today, this gets a little complicated. There's like large accelerated filers, non-accelerated, smaller reporting companies, emerging growth companies. All, if you go back and track it in the history of regulations, have sort of a rationale and a reason. And honestly, when securities offering reform, what they would commonly refer to as 2.0, which was adopted back in 2006, I was at the SEC in the M&A office. There's a part of that that implicated. So I was sort of on that team. You know, there's a bunch of line drawing that happens in these releases, honestly, when you're like, okay, we're going to have a concept of like well-known seasoned issuer or large accelerator files. And we're going to decide that if you have $700 million in float, you know, people are like, well, what's the backdrop for that? Look, I suspect if you go back and look at the release, The Economist came up with a reason as to why they drew that line. It's rare that the SEC and the staff has time to go back and kind of revisit decisions they made in the past. That's 2006. We're talking 20 years ago, right, when that was adopted. So I think people at the SEC are characterizing this as securities offering from 3.0. And there's two parts of this rule. One is the filer status. The other is the securities offering reform, which we'll talk about, but they've kind of been done kind of together, or at least people are thinking them together. So look, if this happens, the idea is they're going to raise the public float threshold, which is currently $700 million for large accelerator files, to $2 billion. So in essence, what they're doing is they are increasing the number of companies that will be eligible to take advantage of the less regulatory requirements for what was viewed as kind of smaller companies, right? So they're going to raise the threshold, and they're going to change when you calculate your public float, which used to be the last business day of the second quarter. Now they're going to have they're going to use a 10 trading day period, so giving you a little bit more flexibility, not just stuck on whatever the trading price was on June 30th. And then once you're in that status, they're going to allow you to stay there for at least 2 years, right? So again, they're like, increasing the threshold to allow a lot more companies to be able to take advantage of the scaled disclosure, less disclosure. And then they're also allowing you to kind of test that and stay within it for sort of 2 years because it's a little bit more kind of predictability. So the SEC, when they put this out, kind of made it clear that like by doing this, they're extending this to a much more significant group of, you know, companies, which I think will be kind of welcomed. And they're also making the sort of whole filer status a little bit less complicated, I would say. Again, this has to get adopted. So we'll see ultimately what happens. I suspect, again, I don't know how quickly this one will happen, but I suspect that this will get adopted. I think the way they proposed it, they'd say the folks who will consider to be, you know, large accelerator filers, the biggest group that will have to comply with all of the sort of more rigorous rules is about 20% of public companies. 80% will kind of fall below that, meaning 80% of public companies will take advantage of the less robust disclosures or requirements. There's another category, small non-accelerator filers. These are a smaller group of companies that like assets of less than 35 million. So again, like a really small group that will have even less requirements. But anyway, again, I'd say we'll see what ultimately gets adopted. Lots of people looking at this and expect to weigh in with comments. I think this has momentum. I don't know that this one will get adopted by the end of the year, but I think that I suspect this will get adopted.
Yeah. And your point about the population of large accelerateds being around 20%, I heard, or I think it was in the release, where that 20% covers like 95% of the market cap, which is crazy. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah, it does cover a lot. So the registered offering proposal that came out at the same time, to me, seems a bit more legal in nature. So I was hoping you could spend some time on that proposal. As what are some of the benefits and why the SEC thinks that proposal was, you know, needed at this point?
Yeah, again, this is a kind of review of the longstanding eligibility requirements for companies to register and sell securities in a form S3. So they are comprehensively overworking or changing the rules that apply here, which will allow very quickly new public companies, exchange listed companies, to promptly file shelf registration statements and take advantage of the market conditions that are available to them in a way they haven't in the past. This is the most significant rethinking of, you know, the use of Form S3, as I mentioned, over sort of 20 years. So what do they do? What do they propose? They propose to, you know, dramatically expand the availability of S3 by eliminating the 12-month Exchange Act reporting history requirement. So in other words, you weren't eligible to rely or file a Form S3 unless you were a public company for at least 12 months, like meaning you've been filing Exchange Act reports for 12 months, which is why I mentioned earlier, like new reporting companies, like our friends at SpaceX, which I think is going off today, exciting, they would be able to file on a Form S3 if this was adopted. It's not adopted yet, but if it was, when in the past, new IPO companies would have to wait for at least 12 months, and then they needed to have a public float of 75 million or more, and that's also been eliminated. So again, this is like allowing more companies to use this in a quicker time, if it's adopted. They also, as you may know, the definition of well-known seasoned issuers, or WKSIs, that was adopted in 2006. The idea was we are going to allow sort of automatic S3 eligibility. So in other words, you know, you could file your S3. Does it need to get reviewed by the staff? If you don't qualify today as a WKSI, you do need to get reviewed by the staff, meaning you have to file it, have to wait to see if the staff's going to review it, if they have comments. If they have comments, then you have to respond to it, and then the staff has to take it effective. Well-known seasoned issuers don't need to wait for that process, because when they file their Form S3, it goes effective automatically. But what they're going to do is eliminate the WKSI definition and come up with two additional categories. One is called eligible listed issuers, and the other one is seasoned eligible listed issuers. I think we were calling them like ELI, eligible list issuers, and Sealy, I think. At least that's what I'm hearing people say. So it's like, just to confuse us, we've got rid of one and we're adding another. So, and again, I've heard that the SEC estimates that about 76% of companies will qualify as ELEs, and about 74% would also qualify as CLEs. So the categories are allowing for, you know, these companies to take advantage of, you know, the benefits of basically the whole so WKSI status. The CLEs, the one that I mentioned, would be eligible to file automatic registration statements, which is what's limited to WKSIs. But the ELEs will also get the benefit of, you know, pay-as-you-go filing fees, the ability to add additional securities after effectiveness, pre-filing and post-filing communications flexibility. So they've rethought all of this, and they're expanding the ability of companies to use it. And there's still a level above the kind of biggest companies. The CLEs will kind of get the most advantage, but it's going to significantly expand to lots of companies to be able to, you know, rely on these rules. So again, not adopted, of course, yet, but I think I do think this is one that will get adopted. There seems to be momentum behind it. All fits very neatly. The semi-annual, the filer status, the registered offering of forms, all sort of in that category that Paul Atkins has been talking about, right? Making IPOs great again. Let's revisit our rules. Let's find ways to be flexible. Let's rethink sort of line drawing that's happened in the past to find ways that maybe we can be a little bit more flexible. Hopefully, I would say, I mentioned earlier, if you weren't eligible to do a WKSI, that you needed to file an S3 that needs to be reviewed by the staff. I hope, and I suspect they went back and looked, like, how often does the staff actually look at S3s if they do need to be reviewed? I suspect very rarely, because, you know, the staff is looking at 10 cases, you know, right? So, well, you know, you were in the groups. Like, I suspect S3s are rarely reviewed at all. Yeah. So why do we need to have these people file them and then wait, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point. So eliminating the 12-month reporting history and then no float. So basically, anybody can just file an S3 after IPO, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, that's right. But like, whether you can do it automatically or not depends upon, you know, your size. But think about this. If you're like SpaceX, use them as an example, like they go public today, if this was on the books, they could file an S3. Now, the S3 would have to be reviewed. But what's the chances if the staff just kicked the hell out of the IPO, are they going to look at the S3, right? Probably not at all. Okay. Now you have it on the market. There's lockups and there's lots of reasons why a new public company may not want to be out in the market, but, you know, maybe. And so why not give them the flexibility? And I suspect most companies like to have as much optionality as possible, which is why today having WKSI status, and, you know, sometimes companies lose WKSI status, right? Because they're late, they forget to file an AK and you're like, yikes. And unfortunately, you know, you have to go tell your CFO, oh, by the way, you know, we just lost our S3 eligibility. Or you know, we either can't use S3 or we can't file automatically. You know, it throws a wrench into the potential process. So having as much optionality as possible in the market, as you know, is super helpful to companies. So I think this will be welcomed. I think, and look, you know, people may have different views as to kind of what they decide to do. Let's hope some of that gets worked out in the comment process. But like, the idea that they're modernizing something that's been on the books for 20 years makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. That's great. Super helpful. I appreciate the deep dive on that one. As accountants, I mean, I think it's helpful to hear your perspective. You did talk about, earlier on, you talked about the SK modernization. Wanted to dig into that a little bit more and, you know, what this request is signaling, what we think we'll see in the way of proposals. You know, a lot of people are thinking this is going to be a massive, there's so much in SK. This is going to be massive. And, you know, you've got then executive comp in there too. So, I mean, do you suspect we'll just see one big proposal coming out on this?
Yeah, I don't know. God bless the folks who are working on this, because you can imagine, right? Like, take out a blank piece of paper and tell us what you'd like to see in the business section of the 10K or the risk factor section or the regulatory section or the human capital section. I mean, there have been a bunch of comments that have been filed. There's been some interesting ideas that have been put forward. And remember, they did have a roundtable on executive compensation disclosure. Very quickly into Paul's tenure, he's been out saying our exec comp rules are too complicated. There's too much information. And so I suspect kind of caught up in that, we'll see, you know, in this reg SK rulemaking, you know, probably some of the exec comp rulemaking. So I don't know. I suspect that they'll do it in piecemeal. I don't know how they'll group it together. As you know, in the past, sometimes if it's too complicated and there's too much in there, it might fall under its own weight. So they might try to peel off kind of pieces. And again, maybe exec comp is an example, right? Maybe they go out with that first. That's a big part of SK for item 402 is exec comp and other things. The part three of the 10K, which, you know, mostly gets incorporated into the proxy statement, right? The vast majority of that. I could see them kind of pulling that out. They already had a roundtable. It's something that people are interested in. Paul talks a lot about it. And I don't know, we'll see. It's a little bit of momentum. And remember, they need to keep in mind, like, time is ticking away, right? Because by the time they get something, we don't have any proposals yet. So they got to get this SK proposal out. Then they've got to get the whole comment process we talked about. Then they've got to get it adopted. Then it's got to go into effect. And there's an effective date, usually 6 to 90 days on the back end. So believe it or not, as we sit here in June of 2026, like, time is ticking away, right? If they're going to get this stuff done, get it on the books and have it working, you know, during Paul's tenure, they kind of got to move on it. So.
Yeah, that's a great point about the timing. I can't believe it. I mean, time flies.
Yeah.
It does. Oh, goodness. This has been super, super helpful. And just, you know, I really appreciate your time with us today. I do have one final question. I thought we could just, you know, wrap up for, you know, those listening that are trying to stay ahead of all this. You know, how should, you know, management, audit committees, advisors, how should they all be prioritizing their focus around these proposals? And are, you know, what kind of advice are you giving your clients?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the one that most, you know, financial folks in the audit committees want to talk about is the semi-annual reporting. And I think it's worth having the conversation about kind of what has been proposed and what the company thinks they want to do. In particular, if somebody thinks like, hey, if this gets adopted, we're going to do it and we think it's worthwhile doing it, I think we need to think about the process and how that works. I know we've had this quarterly close for so long. By the way, many times indentures and loan agreements require that you report quarterly with the SEC. So if someone's going to do that, we'll have to think about whether this process works without a 10Q. Do we need to get a waiver or amend the agreement? So if there's an idea of doing that, I think that's probably the earliest. On the securities offering form and the filer status, I don't know that there's anything in particular that, you know, people need to do. We'll have to wait and see what happens when it gets adopted. Again, I think it will make life a lot easier. But the semi-annual reporting is the one that I would say someone's going to have to make a decision. Like, are we going to do this? Is it worthwhile? I've heard some of the corporate, you know, controller folks be like, wait, I'm not going to close every quarter. I'm not, you know, like, that kind of scares them. I feel like there's a whole bunch of seasoning and thinking that's going to have to go on if they're going to do that. Part of that probably is, what are other people in the industry going to do? And I'm not sure we're going to know that for sure. I did see a survey going around, maybe by the Society of Corporate Governance recently, or maybe you guys are doing your own survey with your clients. But like, if this happens, will we use it? Because I think it might be helpful to kind of see. I don't know that you want to be an outlier. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. If like everybody in your industry is continuing to do quarterly, are you going to be the only one doing semi-annually? And kind of what's the impact?
Yeah.
So I'd say that one is the one I would be most focused on.
Yeah, that's great advice. That's what we're hearing. What, you know, clients are asking, what, you know, what's everyone else thinking about doing? You know, it depends on what our peers are doing. No one wants to be the first one. Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. It's always fun when we get time to catch up. So I really appreciate you spending time with us on a morning. You know, it's been great. So thanks again for your time and your invaluable insight. I know our listeners will appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again. Happy to be here.